here we go. So the Shrek series has a lot of characters which can potentially all have a spin-off film of their own. What was the decision to make Puss in Boots the first kind of character to branch out with his own film?
I think he made a real splash in the first time he appeared in the Shrek movies, and was a bit of a scene stealer, and you know, the personality that Antonio Banderas poured into that character, I think just made such an impact. You know, his like booming voice, that personality coming out of this tiny little furry package, just left such an impact. I think it was just a matter of time. I really do. I mean, even just initially, the idea was sort of floating around DreamWorks for a while. It would kind of catch fire and then sort of maybe dwindle out a little bit, but it never went away. And some drafts got written in it. Actually, the producer that's on the film right now, Latifah Woh, who's just a great creative partner in the making of Puss in Boots, she was on originally, and she kind of rolled off. She produced another movie, Monsters vs. Aliens, and then came back on when I did. So it's been around since 2004. Mm-hmm. But in that time, I don't think there was really much consideration for another character from that world.
Yeah.
Hi, Chris. Technically speaking, what would you say was the hardest sequence to do in the film?
Technically? Probably, well, the section of the movie from the time the beanstalk takes off until the three of them go through the cloud world and into the castle in the sky. There were so many elements there, and actually creating believable clouds was a huge technical challenge. I mean, we had the technology developing. Unfortunately, we had the artists. I mean, it was sort of a matter of time. I always had faith like they were going to get there, but actually, when it came right down to dealing with cloud proportions, that was just a tremendous pain. I mean, I have to say, it's one thing like look outside, look up at a cloud miles away, and it's, you know, beautifully formed and lit. But once you're within a few feet of it, it's just fog. So finding a way to make it proportional to the cats without feeling like it was you were on a soundstage with some dry ice and just, you know, real cheap old monster movie style, it was tough. It was really tough. But I think that I got a lot of depth out of it, especially with the 3D. Mm-hmm. And the beanstalk is just a character in and of itself.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Chris. So you made your way up through DreamWorks, climbing a ladder. I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the process from starting there into becoming a director.
I started off applying for a job on Ants originally. Now it's all coming back to me now. And I was told by a friend who was working there, just bring your work. The guy answering the phones right now is actually a story artist. We're desperate. So just in your luck. So just come in and go through the motions, you got a job. And I flipped San Francisco. I remember showing my portfolio to the head of story, and he leafed through it and just went, oh, I'm sorry, this is just not going to work out. And I didn't get the job. And as I was leaving, I'm sorry, I'm going to try to make this short. What was weird now that I'm remembering is I ran into this woman who was the assistant of the producer, Aaron Warner. And the first time I met her, it was Latifah Woh. And we're just chatting, and you know, and I mentioned like I didn't get this job, and I was about to leave, and she said, "What are you talking about?" She grabbed my portfolio and showed it to the producer, who came out a few minutes later. He's like, "You're hired. Don't worry about it." But now I realize, like, Latifah, who was his assistant at that time, she's producing Puss in Boots, so she kind of got me my first job as a story artist, and I was the complete creative partner in Puss in Boots. But that, like, being a story artist, I think is a great sort of a great way into directing animation, because you just get first crack at visualizing a screenplay, you know, or you're given an outline, and it's just a great training ground for, you know, writing dialogue, blocking out shots, composition. You know, it's sort of like editing your own material. It's just, you get a little sort of mini film school with every sequence you do. And you really get to learn so much about just movie making in general and the process. And so I did that on Ants, and I did it again on Shrek. I was the head of the story department on Shrek 2, and then directed Shrek the 3rd.
Yeah, great.
That's good. Yeah, it's a good avenue.
And I guess following on from that, in fact, now that you're sort of in the director role,
there's so many moving parts, I guess, in a movie like Puss in Boots, and so many different departments working on different bits of light. So how do you even start keeping track of all
it's
those?
It's pretty insane. It's like hundreds of people involved, probably about 400 to 600, I think, at its peak. It's crazy. It's collaborative. I mean, you have to be really, really open. And we have a within that huge organization, there's a tight sort of creative core when it comes to just designing the film and writing the movie. It's a team of story artists, which I think like five to seven at any given time. And really, what you end up seeing on the screen, I would say 85% of it, of the content, comes from that group of artists. And along with a screenwriter who's supporting them, and they're shooting ideas back and forth. I mean, our writer, Tom Wheeler, did incredible work. And there's myself, my editor, and Latifa, my producer. And from there, you start building the story, creating the tone, and then you get every department on board, understanding, you know, singular path, and you do that for about 3 years, and it's constantly evolving, and you're open to ideas, like I said, coming from anywhere in any direction. But it's pretty amazing when it works, because it can definitely fall apart. It can be a fragile thing, but when it's working and everyone's just sort of understanding what you're going for, it's amazing how that many artists can just sort of just create work. It just, frankly, just feeds right into a path. Hmm. You know, so you end up, you know, hopefully, and I think Puss in Boots feels like this. It feels singular. It doesn't feel like there's 150 authors on this movie. You know, it doesn't feel schizophrenic. It worked out. There's a nice chemistry.
Hey, Chris, Mitch.
In other words, I have no idea how it works.
My name's Mitch. I'm from Salty Popcorn.
Yeah.
Speaking of the content that's in the movie, it's no secret that Puss likes to indulge in a little bit of casual catnip every now and then. This is the second time that I've seen him.
It's true. He was sprung with it. He was busted, and then he was busted twice by Johnny Law.
That's right.
I was wondering, in regards to the content. I mean, a lot of the humor that comes from these type of movies caters to both kids and flies straight over the top of their heads straight to the adults, which is a very welcome treat. Where would you, obviously there is a line to be drawn. Has there ever been a joke put to you that you have gone...
Oh, that we pulled out?
Yeah, that you've pulled out.
Yeah, I mean, you go on gut, so you just go on instinct, like, oh, that's really base, that really crosses the line. Usually they're filtered out pretty early. The one joke that was cut out, and actually it would have played great, it would have no problem with content. It was, we had to, and we kept it in there till the very end, and we actually just ended up editing some things out just for pacing, and there was a joke in there. It's probably not even gonna pitch really well in this room, but it was in the scene where Kitty reveals that she doesn't have claws, and you know, just very heart wrenching story. And Puss is very supportive, and he used to share at the end of that sequence that he too once had lost his claws, although it wasn't his claws that he lost. And he starts alluding to this trip to a vet when he was very young, and then he gets really quiet and introspective, and he puts it together, and then Puss says, "I don't want to talk about it." And it was hilarious. It was some of the best animation I've ever seen. It was lit. I mean, who knows? Maybe it'll be on the DVD. And I mean, that was borderline, I suppose, but it's pretty funny. It's probably a good thing it didn't end up. I mean, definitely Antonio reading that line was just reading it. I was like, what's going on here? He got really, really, it became he's just like, this is what I think it is, this would never happen. It was like a real insult to his manhood. So Puss is not neutered.
Guillermo del Toro is the executive producer of the film. What was his input creativity wise in regards to
it was amazing. I mean, just even having Guillermo, the way that he came on the project was just sort of this weird faded thing. I remember I was reading it's all happening in a 24-hour period. I was reading in the trades that he was off The Hobbit or left The Hobbit. I can't remember what variety he said or whatever, but I remember thinking, like, oh, it's such a shame, because I knew. I was like, that's the version of that movie I want to see, just some dark, twisted version of The Hobbit. And I love his movies. And later that day, I found out that he was actually in L.A. He was at the studios looking around. We happened to be showing the movie to the studio to get notes, and you do that every 3 months. And you got 20% of the animation done, but the story was had a good foundation. You know, had its legs under it. And Guillermo accepted the invitation, saw the movie, and just you know just said he loved it, and asked us like, is it can I work on your movie? Is there anything I can do? I would love to be a part of it. So, we made him exec producer like that day, and he was funny. He was just like, but don't you know? He was like, I don't want to fall in love with a film. So he was like, so I have to stay objective. So suddenly he was like, do you not want to be around? I understand, but we worked out a system where we'd bring him in like once every 6 weeks or when we really just needed him and just show him stuff and let him react, like the Giant's Castle designs or architecture in town. And the guy is just, he's a great creative force because, I mean, he saw where we were going, what we were shooting for, and was just supportive of it and encouraging, you know, and always offering suggestions that would make what we had better. You know, he's not the kind of guy that like tears something down and then, you know, says, I wouldn't do it like that. He always, like, sees what's positive in it and just sort of pushes creative that way. If we were ever stuck, the carriage driving scene, just pacing on scenes, like, we just didn't have the pacing down of an action scene, just bring Guillermo into editorial, just sit down with him for 2 hours and just start cutting. And, you know, you learn so much, and suddenly you have this beautifully cut scene, and then Guillermo would go away. You know, and then you'd call him up later going, we're just talking about Humpty Dumpty's character. You want to come in? Yeah. Guillermo comes back in, and it was great. I think it was really good for him. It just sort of kept him creatively just nimble, and he offered, I thought, a really good solution for Humpty, and it was Guillermo's idea that he'd be a more Da Vinci-like character. He's like, show him building stuff. So, like, show that side of him, because you've got this mastermind scheming character, but there's no, you know, you can't visualize that. So, you know, I thought it was great way to show his inventiveness. And I mean, the guy's a great filmmaker, so yeah, whenever we got jammed. And then on top of that, he's a perfect exec producer because just as a buffer between the project and a studio, if you ever needed a buffer, you know, he's the guy that would just say, you know, if the studio ever went like, what are they doing over there again? It was Guillermo who just you know, let them do what they're doing.
He was for the song,
yeah, honestly. Completely. And they loved him. You know, they respect him so much. And to me, that's what an exec producer should be too, is that sort of liaison to the higher ups. And he's shooting a movie right now. Didn't see much of him the last like 3 or 4 months. Yeah. You know, as we were finishing, because he was in pre-production. But the guy's amazing. Just brilliant.
Cool.
Yeah, that was an honor. Yeah.
One of the things I noticed at the end of the film, the credits, you have so much post-production done overseas in India, especially the matte paint. So I wonder why was that?
There were sequences done. Yeah, I mean, not just matte painting. Like,
yeah,
there's an Indian animation studio that DreamWorks is, in business with, and we were the first feature film, you know, that they're trying to work into a pipeline there. So two sequences in the movie were done entirely in India, you know, with video conferencing in Los Angeles. I mean, it was definitely a challenge. I mean, I think we got there with it, and the talent there is amazing. It's a great studio. Particularly for broader animation, they're really brilliant. It took longer though, because the style is so specific with Puss in Boots and the characterizations. But they had two scenes in the film. One was one of the Giant's Castle scenes before they go over the moat. And the other was when Puss wakes up in the desert and the crows are coming around. That was also done in India. But they took on everything, you know. I mean, they were given the artwork, the production design, but they completed two sequences.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they're going to be used more, I believe. I think that's DreamWorks' intention.
How intensive was the voice directing sessions?
They were pretty loose, actually. I mean, it's another sort of pretty collaborative
open situation. Banderas has done a character for a few films now, and And you, I know you worked with him in the other Shrek films.
Yeah, he's a total pro. I mean, he's such a pro in that he actually needs nothing, really. I mean, he needs very little context. Someone like Salma Hayek and Zach Galifianakis, even Billy Bob Thornton, it was the first time they'd ever done that. So I think they were a little just like, what's going on? We're in a dark room with a microphone and I'm with you. And it was funny. I mean, they were actually, you know, even like to see Billy Bob just like a little bit nervous, but I'm very impressed that, you know, that he's willing to just, he did it because he's like, I've never done it before. And I just want to step outside of what I'm comfortable doing. He's got an amazing voice. He was fantastic. I just have to just create as much context for them, really. I mean, and then I do the line readings with them. So I'll play every other character, just at least give them something to play off of. But, you know, we've got our day. You know, we've got our script stuff that we'll get. And then we've got alts for almost every line just to try different stuff. If anybody wants to do improv, if they feel anything, then they're encouraged to do that. And they really become a part of the, indirectly, I guess, part of the writing process, because you end up workshopping all the material. You take all that stuff, you go back to the editorial, you cut it in, and you start, you know, realizing like what works, what doesn't. You're informed by the performances, so you start writing more specific material for them. And they play a real part of like creating those characters.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Puss is obviously part of an existing franchise, and it's a very successful franchise, and it's sort of the first spin-off of Shrek. So how much freedom is there when you're coming to a franchise character like this to create a whole new something entirely new?
Fortunately, we had a ton. I'm so grateful. Like, even the studio was wanting something new, you know, and we were a big proponent of that. You know, we had a character, we knew we could create an entirely new world, new tone, and we're pretty big early on of saying like let's not overlap anything Shrek. The association is he's from that universe. There's a fairy tale fabric to it, but even that we want to treat differently. And they give us a lot of space. Mm. And frankly, they let us fall on our face a few times too. You know, without freaking out, or you know, this pretty supportive environment. Was that what you asked,
yeah,
by the way? Because I have a feeling it had nothing to do.
Well, like, I guess just sorry to ask a sort of a part B to that is, but what kind of influences then were you looking at?
Legend was our big sort of theme. Like, it's going to be epic. Origin story. So a lot of influence came from cinematic figures, sort of legendary, either actors or characters, you know. So I see a Clint Eastwood. I mean, there's a bit of a Western, you know, spaghetti Western vibe, but to me it's more actually Clint Eastwood than Sergio Leone. It's in the fabric, and, you know, Indiana Jones is in there a bit, and James Bond, and Errol Flynn, and
Zorro,
who you get for free, you know. Zorro just comes with the Antonio package, but he's in there too. It was that kind of stuff. So yeah, that really sort of influenced style and approach. Anything that sort of supported that character of Puss in Boots.
When I was speaking to, when we were all speaking to Selma on the red carpet the other day, she mentioned to me that she gets filmed when she's in the recording booth, and a lot of voice actors, when they go in, they've also said in interviews that they get filmed.
Yeah, it's like a little lipstick cam.
How imperative is it to get their physical reactions, and also how funny is it to watch that tape back afterwards?
It's so funny, you know. I've never seen the tape. Now that I think about it, I don't even know what happens to that stuff. But
DVD extra for sure.
No, we just treat it as like, look, it's just an extra bit of information for the animators, you know. But when we're going over dailies or going over shots, we never pull that out. We never reference it. We never even look at it. But it's there for them to have as they're putting together a shot. If there's some, you know, idiosyncrasy, if there's something that one of those guys just do consistently that just feels, you know, it's so right for the character. Or yeah, if you catch them just doing something that's funny, they have it. But it's really funny. It never, like, we never talk about it. Even, like I said, during dailies, it never comes up. So I don't even know how much that stuff is used. Actually, the animators shoot a lot of personal video reference, which is just absurd. I mean, they built, like, for Humpty, like this guy, the lead Humpty animator, built a suit, you know, like an egg suit, so he could videotape himself acting out scenes. I mean, it's really pretty twisted. The lengths that some go, and yeah, that stuff is funny. I mean, that's what the animators really actually, they end up getting a lot of ideas really just from each other, you know. And then they have video to support.
So that gold jumpsuit's out there somewhere.
It is. It's just a really cheap trash can that's attached to some rope. I mean, it's just really choking on DVD or something.
Guys, thanks, Chris. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.